Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Owens of the National Employment Law Project, who discusses the legal fallout from the Supreme Court's recent ruling, throwing out an employee gender discrimination lawsuit against retail giant Walmart. Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses the momentum among labor activists and their supporters battling to overturn a Wisconsin law stripping public unions of collective bargaining rights. And Robert Naiman of the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about why he'll be on board a U.S. vessel in an international flotilla of boats challenging the Israeli blockade of Gaza in late June. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Sudanese army has launched a new attack in central Sudan in the oil-rich district of South Kordofan against separatist rebels, raising fears of a civil war and the run-up to independence for South Sudan on July 9th. In mid-June, Sudan planes dropped 11 bombs in the Nuba Mountains, surrounding the city of Kadugli, an ethnically diverse region. It is home to the long-running insurgency by the Nuba people, who fought alongside southern Christian rebels against forces of the Arab-dominated government during the 20-year civil war. The 2005 Sudan peace agreement led the way to independence for South Sudan, but the Nuba Mountains remain in the territory controlled by the government in Khartoum. Sudan troops are now reportedly preparing for a massive ground offensive in South Kordofan. More than 60,000 civilians have fled the fighting in central Sudan since the Sudan army began its offensive in early June, with reports of ethnically targeted killings. U.S. President Barack Obama has called for a ceasefire in central Sudan, including a halt to bombing raids. This new violence has broken out as leaders in Khartoum and South Sudan agreed on a settlement over the disputed border town of Abyei, which Sudan had earlier occupied, causing 100,000 people to flee their homes. According to the Interpress service, redevelopment activity in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, the epicenter of the 2010 earthquake, has stalled. Over 800,000 people are still living in tents, with little prospect of relocation to permanent housing. A two-month investigation by Haiti Grassroots Watch uncovered a lack of coordination among rival government agencies and international donors, and political rivalries which have contributed to delaying progress on reconstruction activity. There has also been little progress in rebuilding downtown Port-au-Prince, devastated by the earthquake. Last year, Haiti's finance minister invited the Prince Charles Foundation to submit a plan to rebuild the city's downtown area, but no contract was signed. The Haitian government paid the foundation $295,000 for the master plan. But several months later, Port-au-Prince Mayor Jean-Yves Jason cut off talks with the foundation, declaring that the project should be completed by Haitians. A new non-union aircraft assembly plant in South Carolina is the focus of the latest battle over union rights and the drive to protect good-paying industrial jobs in the U.S. The National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, acting on a petition filed by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, has charged Boeing with violating federal labor law by building a new aircraft plant in non-union South Carolina in retaliation against union workers in Washington State for engaging in protected activity, including a 2008 strike. The new $750 million state-of-the-art Dreamliner assembly plant has lower labor and production costs than union factories in Washington State. Wages at the new plant will be $14 an hour, while union wages range from $15 to $28 an hour. In a 2010 interview with the Seattle Times, Boeing executive Jim Alba noted, "The overriding factor was not the business climate, and it was not the wages we pay today. It was that we can't afford to have work stoppages every 3 years." The NLRB took this statement and other comments by Boeing executives to mean the company was actively seeking to avoid unions in reaction to a series of strikes dating back to the 70s. The NLRB complaint is now before an administrative law judge. Boeing has vowed to appeal the case to federal court if it is found to have violated federal labor law. South Carolina politicians and Republican presidential candidates have blasted the NLRB for pursuing the case and are now seeking to cut the agency's funding. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
A 5-4 decision on June 20th at the U.S. Supreme Court threw out an 11-year-old class action lawsuit filed against giant retailer Walmart, representing several women plaintiffs claiming gender discrimination and potentially representing 1.5 million female Walmart workers nationwide. The major issue in the case was whether the lawsuit satisfied a requirement of the class action rules that there are questions of law or fact common to the class filing the suit. The majority on the court ruled it did not. This high court decision raises the bar on what plaintiffs must prove before being allowed to proceed with the class action lawsuit, and will likely make it much more difficult for such class action proceedings to move forward in the future. The ruling is viewed by many legal observers as a gift to Walmart, America's largest retailer, which faced billions of dollars in claims if it had lost the case. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Chris Owens, an attorney and executive director of the National Employment Law Project. She discusses her views on the court's Walmart ruling and the obstacles she sees for future groups of individuals seeking legal remedies to discrimination and other injustices.
Two things were particularly striking, I thought, about the decision. One was that Justice Scalia very explicitly delved into the merits of the case, and he said you can't really decide whether the class has the kind of common interest, the common issues that are the glue, without looking at the merits and sort of the potential for prevailing. That, I thought, was really quite surprising. And then secondly, although he acknowledged that there are situations in which decision-making that is largely subjective and discretionary could be a basis for finding a commonality that would support a class certification, he disparaged every bit of the evidence that suggested that it, in fact, had been discriminatory. So I think that it makes it much, much harder, notwithstanding his saying that it would still be possible to certify a class in that kind of situation. I think it makes it much, much harder to do so, and in some sense signals to employers that they are better off not having standards and explicit policies and instead just having and not having the kind of transparency that those kinds of standards and explicit policies provide, and instead just having a sort of more laissez-faire approach to decision making that makes it more likely that they can avoid class certification in the future.
This would affect potential classes of all kinds, right?
It would affect any basis, race, gender, ethnicity, age, disability status, any basis that's covered by any of the civil rights laws, it would affect. I think it's not as clear that it would have the same impact in a shareholder suit, which is the other big area of class action litigation, but it may. It's just uncertain whether it would.
I thought it was interesting that Justice Scalia wrote that one factor in Walmart's favor was that it had written non-discrimination policies in place. How important do you think that was in deciding this case? And do you think that's a defense, even if the practice is different?
No, I don't think it's a defense. And I was actually fairly surprised to see that Justice Scalia attached much significance at all to it. You know, it is against the law to discriminate. Most major national corporations, and in fact, most businesses that have policies at all have written non-discrimination policies. Every business that's a federal contractor has to have a written non-discrimination policy.
Christine Owens, going forward, it sounds like these particular women, all 1.5 million of them, that their option now is to file their own individual discrimination cases, which seems unlikely in many situations. Is that what's left to them at this point?
That's one of the options that's left. Another that the attorneys for the plaintiffs have indicated they're considering, they may actually pursue these cases on a smaller basis, either looking at a specific store and sort of trying to certify a class of women who had worked or were working at that store, or all the women employed by Walmart stores within a particular region, if they could identify a specific manager who they alleged had discriminated or policies that had been applied within that store or within that region that had had a discriminatory effect on all the women in the store within the region.
How devastating is this ruling to this group of women's efforts or to any group's efforts to win justice through class action suits?
I think it imposes an obstacle that will make certain kinds of cases, certainly large class actions involving challenges to the effects of policies that are not quite as precise. I think it will make those cases much, much harder to pursue either as national class actions or, frankly, as smaller class actions. It remains to be seen whether this ruling will be extended more broadly and have a larger impact in cases that don't track exactly what the allegations were in the Walmart case. That's one of the things that almost always happens. We have to sort of let a decision play out to assess what its ultimate impact is. It doesn't close the door to class action litigation, but it does mean that plaintiffs will have to be much more precise in terms of challenging specific practices that have a discriminatory effect or that have some genesis in discrimination. It may be hard to identify those kinds of practices because a lot of employers either have or will eliminate those kind of practices in favor of a sort of more open-ended process.
That was Chris Owens of the New York-based National Employment Law Project. Visit our website at btlonline.org to learn more about the repercussions from the court's rejection of the Walmart lawsuit. Enormous pro-labor protests were organized over a succession of weeks earlier this year, challenging Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's legislative agenda to strip public sector unions of most of their collective bargaining rights. Even though Wisconsin unions had agreed to all of Governor Walker's proposed salary, health insurance, and pension cuts to address the state's $137 million budget gap, Walker refused to back down. When all 14 Wisconsin Senate Democrats left the state in order to deny the GOP majority a quorum, the Republicans voted anyway and passed the anti-union bill, and what critics charged was a violation of the state's open meeting law. In May, Judge Marianne Sumi agreed and ruled that GOP lawmakers had violated the state statute on open meetings in their haste to pass the bill. But in a 4-3 decision on June 14th, the state Supreme Court ruled that the lower court judge had improperly interfered in the legislative process when she overturned the law. In response to the high court ruling, Wisconsin's public employee unions have petitioned a federal judge to block implementation of the union stripping law. They asserted that allowing the law to take effect would irreparably harm workers because it will be impossible to reverse or remedy employment decisions made while the bill's constitutionality is being challenged. Meanwhile, Wisconsin labor activists and their supporters are gearing up for recall elections scheduled for this summer. 6 Republican and 3 Democratic state senators will face special elections. If the Democrats win 3 of these ballots, the GOP will lose control of the Senate. Organizing is also moving forward on recalling Republican Governor Scott Walker, which cannot happen until he has completed a full year in office early in 2012. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses the momentum among labor activists battling to preserve Wisconsin union rights and protect the state's middle-class workers from a corporate-funded legislative offensive.
What happened last week is we got a big kick in the teeth, or a couple kicks in the teeth. The first one came from the state Supreme Court of Wisconsin, which overruled a Dane County Madison judge who said that anti-collective bargaining law couldn't be put into effect because it violated the open business laws of the government and was done against the law that the state legislature had set for itself about how it was going to function and how there was going to be public access. So the state Supreme Court, which is Republican-dominated 4-3, issued a ruling that was akin to Bush v. Gore. It had no legal basis whatsoever. The legal reasoning was terrible. On the other hand, they didn't care about that, and they just wanted to hand it to their Republican friends. In fact, it appears as though there was some collusion between the Republican legislators and the justices on the state Supreme Court, with the Republican legislators demanding that the court rule so that the legislators themselves wouldn't have to vote again, and they would have voted probably to go ahead with the anti-collective bargaining law anyway, but it would have been embarrassing for them to do so. So they urged the court and put pressure on the court to go ahead and validate the original law. And let's remember what the original law was. The original law said that public sector workers do not have the right to collectively bargain except for wages, and only wages up to the level of inflation. On top of that, several thousand people weren't allowed to collectively bargain who used to be who are public sector workers. And in addition, it was a way to attack the unions explicitly by saying no public sector employer, not just the governor of Wisconsin, but county and city, could deduct from a worker's paycheck their union dues. So this is a big defunding effort of labor unions. And finally, it required labor unions in the public sector to have recertification elections every year. And that's going to be onerous for public sector workers, too. So all of this added up to a tremendous defeat for labor and for the progressive movement in Wisconsin, short term anyway, because this is what all the protests were about. This is what we were trying to stop with all the protests. And at least according to last week, we suffered this defeat. Now we're trying different ways to rectify it and come back. But it's going to take a while, and it was disheartening.
From what I understand, a coalition of labor unions is now appealing to the federal courts to block implementation of the budget repair bill and the features of it, which cut into collective bargaining rights.
Yes, it is. I have extreme doubts as to whether this avenue is going to be fruitful. First of all, ultimately, if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's going to lose because the U.S. Supreme Court is so conservative. And I just don't think there's a great legal case to be made. They said that Walker and the legislature were discriminating between two groups of workers in the public sector. One group consisted of firefighters and police officers, and the other was everybody else. I think there is a rational basis for the government, or at least it can concoct a rational basis for why it proceeded that way. So I don't think that's going to go anywhere. The more fruitful avenue possibly is through these recall efforts that are underway to recall some Wisconsin state senators. The Democrats would have to flip three of those to gain control of the state Senate, which is under Republican hands right now, 18-15. But that wouldn't reverse this terrible law. That would just stop Walker and the Republicans from doing anything else more heinous, and that is only if those Democrats could all be in unison, which is a question mark in and of itself. The big question is whether progressives in Wisconsin are going to be able to recall Walker himself, and that effort can't get underway until November.
Tell us a little bit about the recall elections, given the fact that there was a surreptitious tape made of the Republican plans to recruit phony Democrats to run in the recall elections to sow chaos, create some confusion, and I guess they were hoping to survive some of the recall challenges to the Republicans in the state Senate. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this has been an effort to stall. There are supposed to be elections July 12th. Now, the state Republican Party was putting up, and I believe still is putting up, fake Democratic candidates to run in the recall election. So if that happens, then there'll be a primary on July 12th, and the elections to recall, the final elections to recall the senators would be in August. And this is just an effort by the Republicans to buy time. And it wasn't only that surreptitious phone call. The head of the state legislature, one of the Fitzgerald brothers, a Republican leader, said that's in fact what they were going to do. And it's a very dubious morally, and it's very dubious legally whether you can run someone like that. I mean, I don't think it's going to be successful because, you know, I don't think the Republican running in the Democratic primary is going to win the Democratic primary, but it might be successful in giving, you know, the Koch brothers and other people enough time to raise a ton of money and try to prevail in these close elections that are likely to be close in many of them. But I do think that there is going to be a real showdown with this Walker recall. You know, I got to think that it's possible that someone like Russ Feingold could run for governor against Scott Walker and win, and that would have a dramatic impact, not only here in Wisconsin, but around the country.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine based in Madison, Wisconsin.
Find more information about Wisconsin's labor battle on our website at btlonline.org. Last May, the Israeli military assaulted a flotilla of civilian ships carrying thousands of tons of humanitarian aid through international waters to the Palestinian population of Gaza. The attack on one of the largest ships, the Turkish-flagged Mavi Marmara, resulted in 9 dead, dozens injured, and international protests against Israel's use of deadly force against unarmed activists. Gaza has been subject to an Israeli blockade since the militant Palestinian party Hamas took control of the territory in June 2007, and rocket attacks were launched against nearby Israeli settlements. After the violence against the aid flotilla in 2010, Israel announced it would liberalize the blockade and allow a larger number of civilian goods and supplies to enter the territory. Now, despite Israel's threats to stop them, a coalition of international groups are organizing a new flotilla of ships, which will again challenge the Israeli-Gaza blockade. Some 1,500 activists from about 100 nations will board 10 vessels in late June, which will also carry humanitarian aid, medical equipment, school supplies, and construction materials. The flotilla of boats will include the U.S.-flagged ship, the Audacity of Hope, named after President Obama's 2006 memoir. The vessel will carry 36 passengers, 4 crew members, and 10 members of the press, among them Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and many longtime peace activists. Organizers say the boat will bring no aid, but thousands of letters of support and friendship from Americans to the people of Gaza. 1/4 of the participants signed on to the U.S. boat are American Jews. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. Naiman, who will be aboard the Audacity of Hope, talks about the objective of the flotilla and the significance of the number of American Jews aboard the U.S. protest ship.
There are expected to be about 10 boats. One of the boats will be an American boat. This is different from last year in that there were Americans in the flotilla last year, but there was no American boat. There's now a boat consisting entirely of Americans, the Audacity of Hope. There will be 50 people on board, 36 passengers, 4 crew, and 10 journalists, and I'll be one of the 36 passengers. And we're coming from all over the United States, New England to California, different occupations. More than 1/4 of the passengers are Jewish. So we think this is a new development. This is an international movement, but it's one now with a very vibrant U.S. Component. The writer Alice Walker is going to be a passenger on the boat. Hedy Epstein, whose parents were killed in the Holocaust and who escaped from Germany to England on a Kinder transport, 86 years old today, lives in St. Louis. She will be a passenger on the U.S. boat to Gaza. And other folks that your listeners might know, Kathy Kelly, longtime peace activist, campaigned against the Iraq sanctions, she will be on the boat. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, a longtime activist with Global Exchange, she will be on the boat. There's obviously a new moment in the region in the aftermath of the revolution at Tahrir, the new Egyptian government, not a democratically elected Egyptian government, but one that's somewhat more accountable to Egyptian public opinion. We've already seen some fruit of that in the Fatah-Hamas reconciliation agreement, which the new Egyptian government helped broker, and with the announced and partially implemented steps to open somewhat the Rafah border crossing. It's turned out that that was perhaps less than the original ballyhoo. But nonetheless, it reflects the new political moment in the region where the Egyptian government is somewhat more accountable to Egyptian and Arab public opinion.
Robert, what is the objective in your mind as you board the boat to Gaza to challenge the Israeli blockade? The Israelis maintain that they've loosened and liberalized the supplies allowed to come into Gaza. As you said before, the new government in Egypt, the military government, says that they're now allowing more things in through the Rafah Gate on the Gaza-Egyptian border. What's the objective? And I know your boat actually is bringing in letters and no aid supplies at all.
It's true that the Israeli government, after the first flotilla and all the pressure, began allowing more goods into Gaza. But many aspects of the blockade that existed in May 2010 persist essentially unchanged today. It's still the case that Gazans have great difficulty importing construction materials. There's still damage that hasn't been repaired from the Israeli invasion. There's still restrictions on cement and gravel. Basically, what the Israelis have allowed is some materials in for international construction projects, but if you're a private citizen or a businessman, that's not necessarily going to help you rebuild your home or business. It's still the case that Palestinians can't freely travel to the West Bank and East Jerusalem for study or for medical care or to work. It's still the case that big swaths of agricultural land near the Israeli border is off limits to farming due to the self-declared Israeli buffer zone, a third of Gaza's arable land now off limits. And so most of the elements of the blockade remain today, and we want to call attention to that and bring pressure to that. In addition, we're not only concerned about the blockade, it's part of a larger issue of Palestinian freedom, self-determination, and independence. And we see this as a way to, together with all the other efforts going on, try and break the stalemate that is preventing Palestinians from exercising their right of self-determination.
Tell us about the significance of the numbers of Jewish people on board the boat challenging the Israeli blockade.
Well, I think it's very significant because it's an opportunity for the passengers on the boat to speak to the media and the world about their opposition to the U.S.-Israeli policy. And as you know, as the world knows, these policies are often justified in the name of Jews in general, and American Jews in particular, and U.S. policy is justified in the name of American Jews. So this is an opportunity for these American Jews on the boat. So it's an opportunity for those of us who've been marginalized by the institutions that claim to speak in our name in terms of U.S. policy towards Israel and the Palestinians. It's an opportunity for us to raise our voices and say that we're not represented by these organizations. We don't support the occupation. We don't support the oppression of the Palestinians. We want to see a different U.S. policy that supports Palestinians' right to freedom and self-determination.
That was Robert Naaman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. To learn more about the Gaza flotilla challenging the Israeli blockade of Gaza, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.